Les colloques du Collège de France.
And I will now give the floor to Michael Byers from the University of British Columbia on Que le jeu commence, commercial space mining and the politics of treaty interpretation.
Thank you. Merci beaucoup. Merci au Collège de France. Samantha, c'est un grand plaisir d'être ici. I speak English also, and I will speak in English from now onwards, but I could not resist speaking French in this historic place. How many people in this room are lawyers? Des avocats? Yes. To advocate in English means to argue one side of a case. And one thing that I have noticed as a student and scholar of international law is that good lawyers can argue either side of a case depending on who they are working for. And sometimes if they are academics, in terms of what they believe the world should be like, that our own desires for a better world, a more equal world, can sometimes influence the positions that we take. And most international law professors are idealists because we could be making more money in commercial law. This is not a criticism of my friend Stefan or my friend Maria, but I just want to suggest that the interpretations that you've heard today of the Outer Space Treaty can be countered by different interpretations based upon, if not equally strong arguments, based upon good arguments. And this takes me into a personal story. Shortly after I finished my initial legal education, I was hired to work in the legal office of the Canadian Foreign Ministry. And I learned more in that period than I had learned at McGill University studying law. And one of the things that I learned was that the job of a lawyer in a foreign ministry is not just to tell the minister what the law is, but also to shape legal arguments to support the interests of the state, and more interesting, to seek to influence the negotiation of legal instruments, of declarations, of treaties, to achieve outcomes in the interests of the state, to shape the making of international law through strategic thinking, using arguments, analogies, models, applying pressure when possible, and powerful states can apply pressure, but also responding through collective bargaining by entering into alliances with other like-minded states to counter the lawmaking efforts of the powerful. I left the best job I'll ever have to go to Cambridge University to do a PhD. And in selecting my topic, I remembered my insights in the foreign ministry and decided to write a PhD about the role of inequality in the making of customary international law. Customary international law, as the lawyers here know, is based upon a combination of state practice and opinio iuris, which is a sense of legal obligation. And if practice is an important element, while the United States can engage in an awful lot more practice than Andorra or Liechtenstein, inequality must play a role. Power must play a role. I also came across a book by a remarkable French jurist, Guy de la Charrière, the La Politique Juridique Extérieure. And de la Charrière was a former lawyer in the Quai d'Orsay and also a professor. And this was the first book that I'd read by a scholar reinforcing what I was learning and what I was trying to do, that lawyers think strategically. And I tell you all this because when I engaged with the issue of commercial space mining for the first time 8 years ago, I saw strategic thinking about lawmaking. And I saw that strategy being exercised most visibly by the country that has been the best at strategic thinking about lawmaking for many decades, namely the United States of America. And there were two individuals who led the effort that I was watching. One was Brian Israel at the State Department and then at NASA. He is now the senior lawyer at Anthropogenic, which is one of the big artificial intelligence firms. And the other, a man named Gabriel Swiney, who was in NASA. He is now in the Department of Commerce. And both these men were involved in a wide range of space-related diplomacy and also attending the United Nations Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space. So in 2013, it was Brian Israel who wrote the Commercial Space Mining Act for the United States. And Brian, who is a friend, sometimes writes academic articles, and several years after that legislation was adopted, he wrote in the American Journal of International Law that in the absence of clear acceptance as to a particular meaning of a treaty provision, that national legislation can be used to inform the legal interpretation. That the adoption of the Commercial Space Mining Act was intended in part to provide subsequent practice for the purposes of interpreting Article 2 of the Outer Space Treaty. He admitted to it. In 2020, NASA, and this has already been mentioned today, announced that it would be entering into contracts with space companies to lift small amounts of regolith of lunar soil off of the moon's surface, at which point there would be a transfer of ownership to NASA, and then the company would put the regolith back down, and it would never be recovered, because it's only regolith. It's not worth anything. The whole purpose, and Jim Bridenstine, the administrator of NASA, publicly stated this, the only purpose of these contracts was to establish legal precedents for the purposes of interpreting Article 2 of the Outer Space Treaty. I'm a Canadian, so when I say that I love Americans, it means I love some of the things they do. And one of the things I love about them is their transparency, right? They are playing chess with the board in front of them for everyone to see, while France plays chess with the board behind them where nobody can see, right? But this is great if you're a scholar trying to understand what is going on. And then there were the Artemis Accords. And the Artemis Accords combine a range of different strategies. And I have been, for the last two decades, working on a book on strategies of international lawmaking. And the Artemis Accords are my most favorite example, because there are literally a dozen different strategies wrapped up in the Artemis Accords. Let me start with the simple fact that they are not a binding treaty. This is a strategy, because it's much easier to sign a non-treaty. You don't need to go through a ratification process. In some countries, you have to get the approval of the parliament or the Senate. No, with a non-binding treaty, you just sign it. So it's very easy to get lots and lots of countries on board very quickly for non-binding agreements. It's also possible then to get countries that have ratified the Moon Agreement to sign the Artemis Accords because there's no treaty conflict, because one of them is not a treaty. But then you treat them as if they were treaties. So you have these elaborate signing ceremonies. You have, you know, the head of NASA flies to Brazil to sign the agreement with the Brazilian foreign minister, and there's a band and there are banners, and the president of Brazil comes and shakes everyone's hand for a non-binding agreement. They did other things too. They induced individual countries to sign by offering them astronaut slots. Right? If you sign the Artemis Accord, then you can have an astronaut going to the International Space Station. That's not strategic thinking. That's just straightforward bribery. But it's happened in the process of the Artemis Accords. They started with a small circle of their closest allies. This is the strategy of concentric circles, right? Whereby you get the ball rolling by having the initial signatories being the ones that you can count on. Canada, Japan, Australia, Italy, right? And only then do you roll the ball a little bit further down the field and invite your almost close allies to sign. And eventually you get to India, but only after a while. You engage in what is called serial bilateralism. Samantha mentioned this also. It's a term that was coined by Eyal Benvenisti. And you see this in the Artemis Accords, because the Artemis Accords, they're not multiple documents. It's the same document. And every time it's signed, there's only one of the two parties that is the same every time. And there's no negotiation. You cannot negotiate a change to the words of the document. It's take it or leave it. But every single country they go to is approached one-on-one, take it or leave it. Do you want to be inside the tent or outside the tent? There's no collective bargaining. One after the other, bilateral after bilateral after bilateral, 56 times. If you go back and study the history of the standard of compensation for the expropriation of foreign-owned property, you can see how the United States managed to change that rule back in its favor through literally thousands of bilateral investment treaties, strategic bilateralism. They've been doing this for a long, long time. There's another aspect, and I don't want to take too much more time. You can read the paper. I go through the different strategies that are identifiable there. But the one that I really want to get to is that they have, through this serial bilateralism and through these concentric circles, created a community, a coalition of the willing. And the Artemis Accord states are now meeting privately to strategize how to add more countries to the group, but also how to exercise influence on the Working Group on Space Resources at the United Nations Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space. So they are seeking to use the coalition to influence those negotiations so as to get a result that favors them, by which I mean the United States, and the coalition that it has built around it through a range of strategies that has, as a result of this, become a potentially decisive force. Potentially decisive force. I don't think that the debate is over. There are 193 member states of the United Nations. There are only 56 signatories of the Artemis Accords. More importantly than that, the result is not yet decided. And this means that all of the interests can feed into this negotiation to give us a result that is different from what the United States would prefer. We've seen this happen many times before. The Group of 77 was enormously influential during the 1970s and the 1980s. With the new international economic order, the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. The G77 has, on several occasions, issued statements concerning space mining. And some of the developments advanced by the United States. The national legislation, the Commercial Space Mining Act, and then the Artemis Accords. The statements are actually the G77 plus China, because China in this context continues to want to be regarded as a country of the global south. And these 133 states of the G77 can block any development in the working group, in COPUS, in the General Assembly, and indeed in the change of customary international law, if they collectively bargain. If they speak with one voice. The other thing that's happening is that we are seeing the entrance of safety and environmental considerations into these debates. I've mentioned the issue of lunar dust, for instance, on the moon. We're seeing new focus on lunar coordination. There is an action team on lunar consultation that has been created at COPUS. There is concern about protecting radio spectrum on and around the moon, particularly to protect the potential of the far side of the moon as a location for a large radio telescope. There is a recognition that there are only a few stable lunar orbits, and if we're able to cause congestion and potentially the loss of safe access to low Earth orbit with its millions and millions of safe orbits, then the loss of lunar orbit could come fairly quickly. There's a recognition that in the absence of an atmosphere that anything that is abandoned around the moon could create a major safety hazard for anyone on the surface of the moon. The list goes on, and these different considerations. You know, there are countries that want to put nuclear reactors at the nuclear South Pole, and that is now starting to raise an issue about safety. So these environmental and safety issues are now becoming part of the conversation. So the conversation is not just about is commercial space mining allowed or not allowed. It's becoming a conversation about how should we be channeling this industrial interest, this scientific interest? How should we be protecting humanity and the pristine nature of the moon from unnecessary safety and environmental challenges? And that, I think, with time will make for ultimately a much better multilateral agreement. Some people will say the United States is moving quickly and the United Nations move slowly. And on that particular issue, I say, don't worry. Space is hard. People get really excited about building mines on the moon or going off and capturing an asteroid. And space is hard. It's a vacuum. There are intense levels of radiation. The mechanical problems that can happen ultimately, in most cases, result in the loss of a spacecraft. It's hard. And so all of the timelines that look optimistically at 5 or 10 years, our astrophysics colleague this morning said his timelines were probably optimistic. I think they were exceedingly optimistic. We have time to get this right. Provided, and this is the important thing, provided that everyone realizes that the United States is playing a game. It's very strategic. It's using multiple strategies and tactics. It is trying to get to a particular result. And the only way that you stop them from scoring, well, is first of all to realize that they're playing against you. And then the other way that you enable to prevent them from winning is to find your team. This is not an issue for one country or one scholar or a group of academics. This is an issue that requires that we collectively resolve to slow them down, force serious multilateral negotiations, incorporate those safety and environmental considerations, and get to a result that will serve our great, great, great grandchildren. We have the time to do this right, provided that we recognize that the United States is playing a game that it knows how to play very well, and then work together to slow them down and bring them into an agreement that one day will be a win-win for everyone. Merci beaucoup. Thank you very much.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.